The second instinct is the security instinct. The security instinct has to do with making a living, pocketbook, money. The security instinct is very important. God gave us the security instinct so we would work hard and take care of our families, so that we would provide for a rainy day. I'm all about living one day at a time too, but I'm not the only, I hope I'm not the only person in this room with a life insurance policy. Every month I pay money into a life insurance policy so that after I'm dead, my wife and my child can have something to take care of themselves with. And it's that security instinct, that provisional instinct that I have for my family that keeps that going and makes that okay. The security instinct, jobs, money, all those various things. And when I want to achieve more and more and more, and I work and I work and I work and I work, and I get the new car, as it is with the social instinct, these things can be very fleeting. If I'm the president of the club, getting back to the social instinct, that may grow old after all. Nothing stays new forever. Nothing stays exciting forever. I have to work at it. And in the security instinct, I work and I work and I slave and I slave and I buy a house. And I have everybody come over and I say, wow, look at my house. And they say, what a great house. And then some guy down the street builds one four times the size. And I look at him and I say, oh, that son of a beehive over there built one bigger than mine. And I work and I work. So you can all see that the security instinct is excellent, but when I mischanneled it, it's going to get me into trouble. It's going to get me right into the food. The next instinct is the sex instinct. We are all given a sexual instinct. And we have that instinct that God gave us so that we would recreate ourselves. We would procreate ourselves. So you see that in the area of the sexual instinct, if I have a, people are laughing. I'm not sure if they're laughing at me or they're just laughing, but that's okay. I want to go out with Susie Schmo. And there's Susie Schmo talking to Fred. I'm going to hate Fred. I'm going to be jealous of Fred. I'm going to fear Fred. Why? He's talking to Susie Schmo. Right? I want Fred to dry up and die because I want Susie Schmo for me, right? That's what it's about, right? Now, okay. Well, these various things come into play. One of two things is going to trigger that resentment response, or that fear and resentment response, rather, and that is that you're coming to take away something I already have, or you are going to interfere with my ambitions in these three areas for the future. If you are not interfering with my ambitions for the future, with Susie Schmo, with the new job, with being a part of the group, I will not resent you or fear you. If you are not currently coming to take away what I have in the area of social, sex, and security, I won't fear you and I will not resent you. You are not inflicting yourself on my little sphere of instinct. I hope that that makes sense. I hope I've explained it properly. We want what we want. We want to hold on to what we have, and we want to go forward, and we have ambitions for the future in the area of social, of security, and of sex. Those are very important God-given instincts, and if we didn't have those, we wouldn't do the work necessary, we wouldn't go through the courtships, we wouldn't go through the various things we do, and the human race would cease to exist in a very short period of time. Maybe 100 years, there'd be no more human beings left on the face of the earth. So we can all see that. Okay. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From its stem, all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only mentally, not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That's a huge promise. Huge. How many times we see people say, I can't recover, I'm broke, I can't recover, I don't have a girlfriend, I can't recover, I don't have a boyfriend. Nonsense. When the spiritual malady is overcome, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Very important. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. We just talked about that. So we were sore. We were burned up on our grudge list. We set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal and sex relations which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. We're just going to go through one example, and then since I always get asked this question, I'm going to go through one other example. We're resentful at Mr. Brown. Why? The cause. His attention to my wife, sex relations. If he scores with my wife, it's going to interfere with my sex. And also my self-esteem. If he's making it with my wife, what are people going to think of me? Told my wife of my mistress. It affects my sex relations and my self-esteem. Fear. Now, if my wife finds out that I'm having an affair with Susie Schmo, I'm probably not going to have a very good sex life with her, and it is going to affect my self-esteem because what are people going to think of me now? And you can all see how that's... Brown might get my job at the office. What's that going to affect? Security and self-esteem. Fear. So Brown may get his job at the office. Now, the resentment part of the fourth step is a five-column inventory, not a three. But we're not going to get to the fourth and the fifth columns of the resentment until page 67. But I just want to illustrate one other resentment because I always get asked this, so I'm going to cover it now. People ask me, what about if you have a resentment that's not against a person? So I'll give you an example of one of mine. When I did my resentment list, one of my resentments was against the old expression, blood is thicker than water. And I resented that expression because it always left me out. Anytime someone would say blood is thicker than water, I was now on the outside looking in. Okay? So, I resent the expression, blood is thicker than water. Why? What does it do to me? It makes me feel alienated. What part of self is affected? My social and my security. Why is it my security? Well, you guys have parents that are going to leave you an inheritance, and I don't. You guys have parents that have houses, and we didn't. So you can see how that manifests. It wasn't against a person. It was against an expression. You may have a resentment against the school board or against something. So you can see how that works. It's not always a person. He says institutions, things like that. Very important that not all resentments are going to be against a human being. Okay, let's go to the bottom. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. Well, once I've concluded that they're all wrong, I can just go home and eat because to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Understatement of the year. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. I never improved that situation by trying to manipulate it to my own selfish end. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. My wife has an expression hanging on one of our walls that said, you can be right or you can be happy. You can be right or you can be happy. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. With us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. I looked up the grouch and the brainstorm in a dictionary published in 1940, 39 or 40, when the big book was coming out. The grouch is the slow burn, the guy or the gal that's always mad. They're always in a bad mood. That's the grouch. They're angry, but they're quiet about it. The brainstorm is the rageaholic, tempestuous, you know, getting mad and throwing things and yelling. So the grouch is the quiet, slow burn, and the brainstorm is the yeller, the screamer, that person in, that we know or maybe we are, that throws things and yells and screams and stuff like that. Okay, let's hold it down because some of us are sleeping. Okay. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turn back to the list. Now, this is why you have to have a written inventory, and we're about to get our instructions for the fourth and the fifth column. And when you do the fourth column of your five-column resentment inventory, it will change forever the way you look at that resentment and that person, I promise you. Okay? We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, now this is the fourth step prayer. We just uttered the third step prayer. We know about the ninth step prayer, the tenth step. There's prayer in a lot of this. The 11th step. This is the fourth step prayer. And this is the prayer that I have to say every time I feel these resentments. And this is what it is. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And again, I just promise you that this, I just promise you something that it would make it look better. That the fourth column, excuse me, of the inventory would make you look differently at the person and the resentment forever. But it's not really me that's promise is going to help you. It's the big book's promise. And the big book is promising that. And that's more important than me doing it. The big book is going to now give us something that's going to be a very useful tool. And for me, in most of these resentments, this was the first time I had ever looked at any of this stuff. It said, we avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Referring to our list again. Now we've got the first three columns already done. It's assumed by this point, right? Now we're going to do the fourth column. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, oh boy, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. In other words, what did I do to set the ball rolling on this situation? Because for years or decades, I have looked at this other person's role in things and become more increasingly disgusted as time went on. Now I have to look at my role in this, and it's going to change forever. Sorry, it's going to change forever the way I see the person and the way I see the resentment. I'm going to look at what my part in this was. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been? And here's your fifth column of the inventory. It's right here. These are your defects of character. There's people that will say, well, one of my defects of character is yelling at my wife. And the other guy will say, one of my defects of character is not doing my work at the office. Those are not defects of character. Those are manifestations of the defects of character. And here's what the defects of character are. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Now, it's assumed you're angry because you're doing a resentment inventory. Okay. Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? I'm now holding up the mirror instead of the magnifying glass. I like to hold up the magnifying glass. I like to feel better than you because you suck. But when I have to hold up the mirror and look at me, I'm going to sure get a lot more distance between me and the food. Because looking at you doesn't seem to separate me from the food. it only makes the food that much more appealing to me. And when I hold up the mirror, I am putting greater distance, as directed by God, between me and the next pizza. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mr. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. Now this is going to be the fear inventory. There are three parts to a four-step inventory. There's the five-column resentment inventory. Then there's the fear inventory and the sexual harms inventory. This is going to be part two, separate part from the resentment. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them, we asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. So I'm going to list on a piece of paper in column one what or who I fear. I fear Joe. Why? I owe Joe $17,000 and I can't pay him. I fear Mike. Why? I gossiped about Mike, and I know he found out about it, and I don't want to run into him. I fear the IRS. Why? I hadn't paid my taxes for years when I was in the food. And on and on, and we list them. And we list our resentments in the first part. We're going to list our fears in this part, and we're going to ask ourselves why we had them. It's most revealing to me to see how much of my life is pattern. Selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, all these various things come up over and over and over and over again, and I did not know that until I saw it. OA has evolved over the years. I can remember many years ago, we used to write all these autobiographies, and it has nothing to do with nothing. I went to Mather High School. I graduated in 1972. That has nothing to do with my compulsive overeating. What has to do with my compulsive overeating is the fact that I'm selfish, self-seeking, scared to death, and angry as hell, dishonest. That has to do with my compulsive eating. Okay. Some of us had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem. Oh, sorry. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. My life was calamitous. My life was full of me procrastinating to the point where I created emergency from my procrastination, and I kept trying and hoping that I could dig myself out of a hole that I myself created. And there was an old AA speaker, and he came years ago to Chicago, and he said, the first rule of the hole, stop digging. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Before I go on, I just want to make sure that we understand what it is that we're doing here. This is about the sex instinct running to extremes, and that's what it says. I believe that God gave us the sexual instinct, again, so that we could and would recreate ourselves. And it's a very beautiful thing, I'm told, if it's in a certain situation of a marriage or a committed relationship or what have you. It is very pleasurable. If I am using sex for something other than pleasure or procreation, that is something I better take a look at. For example, am I in a sexual relationship with somebody that I care nothing about, but I just want to be in with the in crowd, and so by having a sexual relationship with this person, I'm really going to satisfy my social instinct? Am I using my God-given sex powers to have sex with somebody just because I'm not lonely and they'll pay attention to me? Am I using my God-given sex powers to have a relationship with someone merely because they are providing my needs and my security instinct? Maybe they're paying my bills and I care nothing for them, but I'm in a relationship with them or I'm having sex with them to provide for my security instinct needs. Am I trying to manipulate someone in a sexual sense? Maybe they're Democrats and I want them to be Republicans. Or vice versa. And sometimes it's not just the using of sex, it's the withholding of sex. Am I withholding sex? Am I withholding affection? Am I being selfish to try to manipulate another person and control them? That's something I better damn well look at. Am I using or withholding sexual prowess or powers for something other than what God intended for them? This is what we're talking about. Maybe my sex partner wanted me to do something, and I told him no. Maybe I need to give in a little bit more. Maybe I need to be less demanding that they do certain things that they've expressed to me on 10,000 occasions they're not real comfortable doing. Those are the kinds of things that need reviewing. Because the more I try to power drive my sex partner through things, the worse my life is going to get. Because I am manipulating another person, and I need to remember that that is not going to distance me from the food. It's going to bring me closer. Why? It's self-will. It says in the big book, any life run on self-will. It doesn't just say alcoholics. It doesn't just say compulsive order. It says any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Am I using myself, my sex powers, to manipulate another person? Maybe I'm using sex to get even with somebody to hurt them. Maybe I'm in a sexual relationship with Susie because I'm really mad at Freddie and he likes Susie, so I'm going to date her and I'm going to be in a relationship with her even though I care nothing for her. I'm just doing it to her. I see some smiles. I'll try not to single you out. But the bottom line is, am I using sex for something other than what it was intended for? We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Once again, I'm going to hold these defects out to a column. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Answer the questions. Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. Now, when I first did my first four-step inventory, I had never been on a date with a girl in my life. I went on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years old. Most of my friends were married and in and out of zillions of relationships, seemingly, by that time. Some of them had kids of their own by that time. And so I went to my sponsor then and I said, you know, I'm a virgin. I've never even held hands with a girl that where I wasn't at a meeting or it wasn't my mom. So what he made me do was do all my relationships and hold them up to this. Who was I friends with in a manipulative way? What was I doing in my life that was manipulative and controlling of other people? And it was quite revealing to me. Now I've been married now for 18 years. Hannah's 15. 17 years, sorry. 17. Strike that from the tape. I've been married for 17 years. We've been together for 19 years. And so it's a little different. But the bottom line is I have to hold all of this stuff up for reasons which I want to hold God's hand and let Him be the director. And I must give everything over to God, holding nothing back. These are very important concepts. They're here for a reason. They say if you want to hide something from a compulsive overeater, put it in the big book. This is very simple. This is very simple. We don't need to go out and buy, we don't need to go out and reinvent the wheel. We don't need to go out and reinvent the wheel with all these four-step inventory guides. Did you ever have sex with a chicken while you were on an elevator? Or did you ever kick a goat while you were visiting a farm with your school project or whatever, you know, your field trip? All you need to do is answer these questions. There's not a person in this room that doesn't know the answer to every single one of those questions. We all know the answers to those questions. It's a matter of getting them down, and it's a matter of doing it. Continuing on, it says, in this way we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relationship to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we had done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. And that's so overlooked. I get the right answer when I want it. Who recovers? Those who want to badly enough to take the action. What is the first step in understanding something? Wanting to. I have to want to. My confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. That's a good one, so I'm going to say that again. My confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. My confusion is equal to what my ego does not want me to see. My ego is stomping its feet and grabbing onto anything it can grab onto so that I will complicate these very simple things. These are simple. And yet in my mind, I make them very, very complicated. Because my ego just wants me to say, oh, screw it, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to go to meetings and diet with group support. Okay. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. And that's the whole thing there again. It really is, are you sorry? Are you willing? That's the whole thing. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. So it says on the previous page, we don't have the right to make amends where it would still bring more harm. In other words, Hi, Mr. Jones, I've been kissing your wife for 3 years, but I promise I'll stop. I don't have the right to do that. And if I'm still kissing his wife, is that amends? Is that no? Because if I'm still doing it, and I'm not sorry, and I continue to take that action, then it's not amends. And I am going to eat again because I'm living in self-will rather than God's will. And it's that simple, but yet that complicated. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct, and we are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you will read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from Him. If you have already made a decision, step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you have made a good beginning. After step 4, you're not done. That being, so you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Before we break, I just want to sum by saying this. When it says you've learned and digested some real facts about yourself, this was my experience, and I don't know how it is for anyone else. I could not have learned more about myself if I tried. I saw how dishonest I was on paper. I saw how selfish and self-seeking I was. I saw what a manipulator I was, and it made me sick. All of my life, I have looked outside myself, and I thought to myself, if they would only do this, if she would only do that, if they would stop doing that, and just if everything was okay out here, then everything would be okay in here, and I wouldn't eat. What I learn is that the world that I was born into is a world where all of these various people have a will and a mind, and they have a God, and there's going to be things that are going to be in collision with what I want. If you're struggling with step 4, please think of this. I have a daughter at home. Her name is Hannah. You're going to hear a little story about her tomorrow if you're here. My daughter is 15 years old. And if I said to my daughter, Hannah, I want you to go in your room and clean it, she would use bad language. Golf words, lots of words that I wouldn't say. If I said to my daughter, Hannah, come over here. I'm going to give you a Visa card with an unlimited limit. I want you to go in your room, and I want you to take out of your room and put in front of the house in the dumpster anything or everything that you want updated, replaced, or renewed. I want to give you brand new things, but what you have to do is clean out the room. The only thing in that room would be German shepherds. We have two of them. There'd be walls. That would be it. God is extending that deal to you. Test Him. Try Him. He won't let you down. Take this inventory. Do the step. Stop waiting to have the perfect food plan and be in perfect recovery to do the perfect fourth step. Just do it. It doesn't have to be perfect. It says it has to be done. Fearless and thorough. You've got a tenth step. You've got an 11 and a 12. You've got the rest of your life. There are things that got by me. There are things that are going to get by you. Oh, yeah, I forgot that I resented Joe Blow or whatever that might be. I've got a 10th step for that. Stop waiting for perfection. Stop waiting for the things to happen that are going to be just right so that now I'll do it. Get it done now. The big book says next we launched out, and it says now. And it gives us, specific time frames. And just remember this before we break, and then we're going to come back hopefully. Some of you are still awake, so we'll hold it down. Okay. Just remember this. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just needs to be done. And in some short periods of time, you all know who you're mad at. You all know who you fear. And you all know the sexual part of it for your life. It's just a matter of writing it down. And it's a matter of holding God's hand. And it is the most beautiful, easy process when you do it. And you will learn so much and grow so much from it. And the world around you is going to start looking very, very different. When you were hanging from the chandelier, not eating, in stark raving abstinence, dieting, the world was a very tough place. That's an exhausting way to live. This is emancipating. This is freedom. This is beauty. This is God. Let's break. We'll be back in 10 minutes. I don't want John getting mad at me again. Then he'll have to work out all those resentments, and he'll have to be doing steps and making amends to me, and we want to avoid that if we can. We just talked about the first four steps. We talked about the fourth step in detail, and we've understood that there's a God that loves me, and that if I am just going to remember that He does love me and He's not going to hurt me, that's a lot to remember. And that this inventory is a very simple thing, and that He's going to replace everything in my closet that needs replacing, and He has an unlimited budget. Does that mean that I snap my fingers and it's like a genie where I get Lamborghinis and all the... No. What it means is I get to be on a different footing and I get to live free of the food. Overeaters Anonymous will not teach me how to have what I want. It'll teach me how to want what I have. It'll put things in a new perspective. And the fourth step is instrumental in that process. It's absolutely vital to my survival. Page 72. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. A couple of things are going to happen as I do my fourth step. I'm going to uncover, I'm going to discover, and I'm going to discard. I'm going to uncover, discover, and discard. As I do my fifth step, and I say these things to another human being, what starts to happen is something that I alluded to hours ago, if you were here this morning, and that is, in the absence of a spiritual awakening, I cannot look at the world with right eyes. I'm either going to look up at you, or I'm going to look down at you. I cannot look at you when I'm in the food. The food clicks me in just right for about 30 seconds, and then it starts going haywire again. Part of the process of this program is to make me feel and be more comfortable as a human being living in God's world. It puts me right with myself, right with God, and right with my fellow human being. And that's very important for me to remember. And as I confess my defects and talk about these things with another human being, and they don't just pass out. They don't just drop dead. What I find is comfort in knowing that these things that I thought were secret unto me, things that I thought I would take with me to the grave, are things that when the light is shined upon them, they become less and less dangerous to me. And in the telling of these things to another person, I get more and more separated from the food instead of closer and closer to it. It is very important for me to remember that as this person also takes my fifth step and they start sharing their things with me and me with them, I feel a certain comfort for the first time in my life, for me, the first time in my life, of being a person that is a human being among many people. Remember that I define, or I have to remember that I define humility as the God-given ability through action and work, but the God-given ability to be one of many. And doing that fifth step is something which starts to make me feel like I'm part of the world. Like what I have done, what I have thought, what I haven't done and haven't thought were not so abnormal. I start to feel more comfortable in my skin. And that's so important for me. Okay. This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. A solitary self-appraisal being insufficient is the understatement of the things look very different in my brain than they do when they see the light of day. My illness festers in darkness and withers in light. When I show these secrets to another person, I start to get better. I start to move away from the food instead of closer to it. George? Oh, okay. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone all their life story. And for me, what that boils down to is step two. Do I believe in God or I don't? Do I trust God? Do I trust God enough to follow the instructions in the big book and do my four-step inventory and not have ideas on how I'm going to do this myself? I have to not be thinking, I'm going to save this and not tell anyone that, but this is the things I'll tell and these are the things I'm not telling. Oh no. Oh no. Oh no. I cannot be holding on to some of the worst items in stock. I must trust God enough so that I will go forward with the program of action. More than most people, am I there yet, George? More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he hopes he pushes them, these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. And once again, I'm going to be reminded that when I'm not in fit spiritual condition and I'm not doing these steps, it's the most exhausting way to live. And when I am that bereft of energy, I'm going to pick up the food. It's that simple. How do I know that? I've tried it 20,000 times. Every single time I try to power drive this world into what I would have it be, on my terms, how I want it, I end up in the food. When I do the work in front of me with the program, I end up free of the food. It's that simple, and yet my ego will say to me, this time will be different. Remember Dr. Silkworth told us we cannot discern between the true and the false. I'm going to fool myself that if I don't do the work, I'm going to be free of the food. Baloney. Baloney. I'm not going to be. Okay. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chance of recovery. We must, here's that word again, be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world, rightly and naturally. We think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must and, of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with somebody ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. If we cannot or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintance or a closed-mouth, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. It may be one of our own family, but we cannot disclose anything to our wives or our parents which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story we tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. In other words, we hear this again and again, that it's a selfish program, and it's really not. It's telling us right there we have no right to save our skin at someone else's expense. We have to be considerate. In other words, if there's some of you in this room or me who have people that will be affected by what it is we're going to say to them, we have no right to say it to them. We have no right to say, particularly say to a son or a daughter, we have no right to give them our four-step inventory if one of the resentments is against their parents or their sibling or something, because it is going to affect them. So we have to think about these things before we go forward. And when we do go forward, we have to do it unreservedly. But we have to just give it a little thought. Is this someone who's going to be affected? And if the answer is yes, find someone else. Where God guides, God provides, and if you're really willing to do the step, He will provide for you someone which will be the perfect person with which to give that fifth step inventory, I promise you. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. Okay. George? Okay. Notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one so situated that there is no suitable person available. If that is so, this step may be postponed. Only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious. We say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence, that he fully understand and approve what we are driving at, that he will not try to change our plan, but we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. And that's pretty self-explanatory. That's something I just want to consider, and I just want to go forward. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. Now, you're going to hear the step-a-year thing. No time. We don't waste any time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we have taken this step with holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. What a gift. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. You don't have to wait for page 83 to get promises. You don't have to wait for page 83 for the big book to promise you things that are miraculous in their scope and in their nature. And all I know is my own experience with this, and that is I had beliefs because of what I had done relative to writing bad checks, relative to lies I told, relative to people that I had hurt, relative to things I did that I wish to God I could undo, things I wish I had done that I would give anything to go back and do. I thought that these things were secret unto me, and when I disclosed them to another person, through the resentment inventory, through the fear inventory and the sexual harms done others inventory, there was like a gate unlocking, and I immediately did feel, as we were going through it, I really did feel like the food situation was behind me, and it proved to be true once I did my last one. I have not compulsively overeaten, and that is a miracle for me. But what's beyond not compulsively overeating are the various other things that it promises me. I can walk around, and I don't have to worry about what lies I've told, and I don't have to worry about what hand grenades are waiting to go off in my life. I can walk around emancipated from me and my defects. Not the other people, not the boogeyman in the closet, from me. And that is so much the miracle of it. To be at peace with me. To be at peace with God. To be at peace with my fellow human being is something miraculous. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Now, this is going to be the only hour you're going to get a rest from, so use it wisely. Carefully reviewing what we have done, we thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? If we can answer no to our satisfaction when we look, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And so I'm not just up here talking to myself. If you have taken the first 5 steps, and you would like to say the prayer with me, I invite you to do so, so that I'm not up here saying it alone. And there are some people in here that are asleep, so please hold it down. But when ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that You should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that You now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to You and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do Your bidding. Amen. We have completed step 7. 2 very short paragraphs. 6 is a paragraph. 7 is a paragraph. And they are very short, but they are very, again, misunderstood steps. Am I saying, God, help me be on time for work? Or, God, help me be on time to the 5:30 meeting at the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club for once? No. What we're doing is we're asking God to rid us of fear, anger, self-seeking, dishonesty, selfishness. And when these things are given to God on a daily basis, I will not find it necessary to compulsively overeat. The desire for the food is gone. Now we need more action. There's that word again, action. Without which we find that faith without works is dead. Now we read faith without works is dead in Bill's story, and we see it again here. And the original company that published the big book was called Works Publishing Company. And when Bill was in Akron and he was living with the Smiths, Dr. Bob and Ann Smith, Mrs. Smith, Ann Smith, who was a very religious person, she would read to them from the Bible every morning when they would take their devotion. And they loved King James. I'm not sure what that is, but that's what I know he liked or what they read. And Mrs. Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, Mrs. Smith, her favorite Bible verse was, "Faith without works is dead." My wife has an expression that she learned in another program, and I love it. And I've heard sports people use it. I've heard business people use it. "What you're doing is screaming so loudly, I cannot hear what you're saying. What you're doing is screaming so loudly, I can't hear what you're saying," to me means it's action. It's action. I can think what I want to think, but what am I doing? That's the key. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we have harmed and to whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. Now, your harm list should come from your resentment list and your fear list and your sexual harms done others lists. You should have everything you need to get ready for 8 and 9 from your fourth step inventory. Why is 8 a specific step? Because anytime you go to an 8-step meeting and it's supposedly like a step meeting, invariably the conversation will bleed over into 9. One of the things that I have experienced, and one of the things that maybe some of you have experienced, is having harmed people that are dead. Having resentments against people that I've never met. Having resentments against people that I will never be able to... Thank you. Oh. Belief in God is one thing, but without coffee, come on, you're really testing my faith there. Okay, thanks. Thank you. Thank you. I don't know if any of you fall into this category, but I have people that I have harmed that I needed to make amends to that I will never in this lifetime be able to make amends to. My mother died when I was 22. My father died when I was 24. They never knew me as a recovering person. They have been gone 35 and 33 years. They do not know my wife, nor my daughter, nor anything. And so the person that I am today would be very foreign to them. The only similarities between me and that little boy that they raised are a name and black hair or something, I don't know. But I'm really not that person. And I harmed them tremendously. I loved my mother, but she was not what I wanted. I wanted Robin Laura Petrie. I wanted something different than what I got. And retrospectively, and it took a long time, I did everything and anything I could to hurt her. I did anything and everything I could to strike her in the heart because of her mental illnesses. I would have done anything I could to hurt my mother. Her crying was music to my ears.